Our founders, and notably James Madison, were fascinated by ancient Rome. Not so much because of its triumphs, which were many, but because of its failure. And specifically one particular failure, the failure of the Roman Republic to survive. You see, this fellow named Julius Caesar showed up and decided maybe he'd like to be an emperor. And then some other people showed up and decided maybe not. Well, today we've got Barry Strauss of Cornell University, who's just written a fascinating new book. It's called The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination. And I know you're going to enjoy our discussion. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, it's about the death of Caesar.
Stay tuned for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
If you're a regular listener, you already know that James Madison spent several months in the winter of 1786 to 1787 studying history, studying the history of democracies and republics and why it seemed that they almost always failed. Perhaps the biggest failure among the ancient civilizations that he studied was Rome, and specifically the failure of the Roman Republic, which had been around for hundreds of years and which had built the most powerful empire in the history of the world, arguably. Why did this republic devolve into tyranny? Why was it replaced by a series of emperors, some good, some bad, that ultimately led to the ruin of Rome? Well, today we're going to talk about that process. We're going to talk with Barry Strauss, who's written a marvelous new book called The Death of Caesar, The Story of History's Most Famous Assassination. Barry is a remarkable fellow. He teaches at Cornell University. He's a distinguished historian. He's the Bryce and Edith M. Bomar Professor of Humanistic Studies. He's got awards coming out his ears. And recently we sat down and we talked about his new book. Unfortunately, I had to cut out about a third of our interview because it was so fascinating that I couldn't shut up and I didn't want him to shut up. So I'm going to pick it up when Barry starts to tell us about the origin of the Roman Republic.
Rome began as a small town on the hills at the crossing of the Tiber River, about 20 miles in from the sea. There was a crossing there because there was an island, and there is an island in the Tiber. It was an agricultural settlement that grows, a trading center that grows into a city and eventually becomes a military power, conquers central Italy, then all of Italy, and then a Mediterranean empire. In the beginning, it is ruled by a series of kings, some of whom come from the outside. They're Etruscans. And the kings are driven out in a revolution around 500 BC that establishes the Roman Republic. The Republic is a citizen form of government. The ancients thought of it as a mixed constitution. It had a part of it that was popular. The people would take part in assemblies. They would vote and pass laws. Part of it was aristocratic. There were officials elected by the people for one-year terms, but they were kind of like kings for a year in their positions. And then there was a council of elders. In Latin, a council of elders is called senate. It's where we get our word senate from. And these were ex-public officials. They'd be in this council for life. And they had informal advisory power. But in fact, they were the most powerful people in the state, this council of elders. And so the Roman Republic, at its most functional, balanced the interests of the people against the interests of the elite. It balanced the interests of the many and the few. It didn't blend them. Rather, the Roman ideal was a dynamic balance, a give and take, argument, debate, sometimes conflict. The few, the 1%, if you will, had enormous power in Rome. Rome was not egalitarian.
These were called the patricians, right?
Originally, they were called the patricians, but that term loses its meaning relatively early in Roman history. They're called, the most powerful people are called the nobles.
And if I recall, again, I'm hearkening, this is really fun. I'm thinking back all those years, back to my undergraduate days. Noble originally simply meant to be well-known, right?
Originally, yes. But noble comes to mean people whose ancestors hold the highest public offices in Rome. Very, very small group of several hundred. families. And these are the most powerful people in Roman politics. The sheer amount of inequality in Rome dwarfs our modern inequality, just because the poor were so poor and lived such precarious lives, which fortunately most of us, at least in the developed world, don't have to live today. But enormous inequality, but not complete inequality. And in the Republic, ordinary people did have some say and some influence.
And these were called the plebeians, right?
Yes, they were called the plebeians. They're also the poorest people are also called the proletarians. And proletarian means breeder. It literally means breeder. The idea, somewhat insulting, is that all they contribute to the society is they breed. They make children. So, yeah, the plebeians in general.
And then a subset of these lower classes were the landless proletarians or plebeians who lived in the city itself, and they were simply called the mob.
Well, the mob would be an insulting way of calling them. Perhaps a more neutral term would be the urban plebs.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the people of Rome. Many of them are indeed landless. A large number of them depend on government grain distributions or government subsidized grain, heavily subsidized grain. Many of them, both in the city, but particularly in the countryside, join the army because the military is the main ladder of social mobility for ordinary people in Rome. Originally in the Republic, the military consists only of citizens who own land. These are small farmers. But as Roman society gets out of joint for a variety of reasons over the centuries, the soldiers tend to be poor, landless people. They are an armed proletariat. And as you can imagine, they are a source of revolution. They follow their generals. They want their generals to reward them with loot, with high pay, and with land. And the generals, to get that, have to take land away from somewhere else. So in the last century of the Republic, this is the main cause of instability and why the Republic itself, the future of the Republic itself as a political institution, is in doubt. So,
now, before we get there, you've mentioned the institution of the military. Let's talk a little bit about that since you're a military historian. Once again, now you please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the strength of the Roman legions lay not so much in its technological superiority, not in any sort of physical superiority of people from the vicinity of Rome or from Italy, but rather in its remarkable organization. Is that considered to be the truth among historians?
Yes. Now, the Romans, mind you, the Romans were extremely good engineers, and their ability to carry out sieges and to use artillery is no small thing. Mm-hmm. But their single greatest advantage is their discipline and their organization. That plus their manpower. And the Romans have huge manpower resources because they are the most prudent and clever alliance managers in history. The Romans figure out better than anyone else in the ancient world how you run an alliance and how you balance carrots and sticks in order to get people to follow them. You use the stick to defeat them, to make them afraid of rebelling against you, but you use the carrot to make them think, you know what, being a Roman ally is a great deal, and we are better off sticking with Rome than rebelling against Rome.
And one of the biggest carrots that was offered to a vanquished people was the possibility of becoming something called a Roman citizen, right?
Precisely.
Could you talk about that? What does it mean to be a Roman citizen, and who was eligible to be one?
Well, being a citizen of any republic, any commonwealth in antiquity, the ancients tended to think of citizenship as a privilege. And they tended not to extend citizenship to immigrants. They sometimes did, but in general, immigrants had to come and be they would be permanent green card holders, if you will. They never get to be citizens. Some states begin to see that that's not such a great idea. They need to rejuvenate their population. They understand that bringing in outsiders adds strength to their population. The Romans are the first to really bring this on a mass level. Well, they're not the first, but they take it further than anyone else has done. They begin to extend it to the people they're conquering in central Italy. They start with other speakers of Latin. Romans speak Latin, but there are other people in central Italy who speak Latin as well. But they extend it further eventually to all the people they've conquered in Italy. And then in the empire, they slowly, little by little, extended to all of the free population of the empire, from Britain to Iraq, and from Germany to Egypt and the Sahara and North Africa. So it becomes an enormous thing. But it starts out slowly. But the people who are conquered, the Romans say, if you behave, we'll let your sons become Roman citizens, or we'll let them become citizens. They don't have the vote, but they have the rights of citizens. What are these rights of citizens? You can do business in Rome. You can marry Romans so that their children will be Roman citizens. You can take your cases to Roman courts before Roman judges. You can't be whipped or tortured. So the Romans extend those, and it's a very wise thing to do. And they also cleverly extend it little by little. It's a privilege. It's not for everyone.
Now, you say not every citizen got to vote. What were the qualifications to actually vote, to be someone who might actually elect a senator?
To actually vote, you have to be a full Roman citizen. But the Romans invent a sort of halfway house for these allies. It's called citizenship without the vote. Some people would be that in that position, and then eventually the Romans would extend full citizenship to them. But for those who are born Roman citizens, you can vote. Now, the voting, that sounds great, but in fact, it's not as great as it sounds, because the voting is done by a very rigged system that favors, again, what I'll call the 1%. Mm-hmm. And often in Roman elections, the poorest people never get to vote at all, because the vote is declared over after the rich have voted, after the wealthy have voted. Rome, again, class organized, a class-biased, class-based society.
So this is a republic in the sense that there is some degree of voting, and there's some degree of selection by some segment of society, but it turns out it's a relatively small, it's really sounding more like an oligarchy, or maybe an extensive oligarchy, than it is like a republic as we would understand it.
It's a complicated oligarchy. I wouldn't call it simply an oligarchy, because these elections do involve more than just a tiny percent of society. And there are other ways in which ordinary people can have their voices held. There are public assemblies. There are no elections held at the assembly, but there are speeches. And people pay attention to the opinions that ordinary people express at these speeches, either in speaking or in applauding. They can riot, which might sound like a council of despair, but it happens, and it's significant. They can also provide escorts to the rich and powerful. And these escorts, not only can they sometimes provide physical security, but they're a sign of the greatness of the power of somebody. So I wouldn't say that the ordinary people have no power in Rome. It's limited, but it does exist.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm just enjoying the heck out of a conversation with Barry Stewart Strauss, who is the Bryce and Edith M. Bomar Professor of Humanistic Studies at Cornell University, and the author, quite recently, of a book called The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Barry Strauss. Stick around. This week's quiz, like several before it, was recorded in Lithuania when I visited Vilnius University and talked to some of the international students there. Well, I have with me a very reluctant participant. And what is your name, young lady?
Hello, my name is Linda.
Linda, and where are you from?
Yeah, from Czech Republic, from Brno.
Brno?
Yeah.
Really? And that's spelled B-R-N-O, right?
Yeah. And yeah. It's much prettier town than Plzeň.
So you're sitting right next to Vojta, who was on another quiz, and he is from Plzeň, and you think that Brno is prettier.
Yeah.
Do you also claim that you invented beer there?
Yeah, of course, we have much better beer than
much better beer.
Of course, everybody knows in Czech.
Of course, everybody knows that. Okay, well, I'll have to visit one of these days.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I'm curious as to your knowledge of the American legal system. So I'm going to ask you about a very famous case in the American legal system, and you're going to tell me what you know about it. Have you ever heard of the O.J. Simpson case?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe? In fact, do I seem to recall you did a presentation on it in class earlier today?
Yeah, it's true. You're
okay,
right.
Well, here's your quiz.
I remember now.
Was he convicted or not?
Oh, it's a question, but I think yes.
Okay, was he actually convicted?
If
was he actually put in prison?
No.
He wasn't, right?
He was found not guilty, but I can say if I was in the jury, I probably found him guilty.
It was very controversial, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really. And I think there are a lot of background things they push on this case. So, for example, media or his jury or his defendants.
Uh-huh, his defense lawyers?
Called Dream Team, so I think in this case won the money, not the...
You think the money won the case?
Yeah, not the justifies.
Really?
Yeah.
So if O.J. Simpson hadn't had so much money, what do you think would have happened?
I think he was found guilty.
Yeah. It's a very interesting thing in our American legal system that it's very, very difficult to convict someone of a crime. You have to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. So you have to be about 99.9% sure. But as you know, he was then later tried in a civil proceeding where he was found liable for exactly the same thing. And that's because the burden of proof in that is much lower. You only have to convince somebody to about a little over 50%.
Yeah, they was convicted and had to pay a lot of money to family of Nicole Brown. Yeah.
Very.
I think it's because of the jury, because it's they are normal people, so for them it's not, I think, much more about law, but more about their feelings, and I think they saw a lot of news in media, and it was very hard to decide this case for them. Like for normal, not lawyers people. Yeah.
So you think the media had a lot to do with what happened in the?
Yeah, of course, like always.
What should we do about that? Is there anything we should do to protect the judicial process from the media?
Once again, please.
That's all right. Should we somehow restrict what the media does in order to protect the judicial process? Is there anything we can do to fix that?
I don't know. I think this time it's much more worse because there are more and more medias, and we have social media like Facebook or Twitter or something. And for people, it's too hard to follow and to check it if it's fakes or it's really right. So I think it's hard.
It is very hard because, of course, especially in the United States, we have very strong protection for press freedom.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's a very important value. On the other hand, as you've pointed out, fake news is undermining much of our democratic process. And to some extent, it might be undermining the also very important constitutional right to a good trial, to a fair trial. So it's a tough, tough situation. So you're not going to solve it for us today?
No.
Okay, maybe next year.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda. We appreciate your time. All right.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Barry Strauss, the author of a number of books, but most recently, The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination. Now, to understand the significance of Caesar and his assassination, you have to go back and you have to understand what existed beforehand. And what existed was something called the Roman Republic. It had existed for hundreds of years. But when we use the word republic, we're not using it, not in its modern sense. There was participation. There was voting by a number of people. But there was also enormous inequality in Roman society. And so just before the break, Barry was telling me that regular people could participate, but their participation was much more limited than the average voter in the United States today.
Before we leave the subject of the Republic, and we could obviously talk for a long time about it, one other thing that really struck me when I was studying this as an undergraduate was that most of the territorial conquest of the Roman Empire was actually achieved under the Republic, wasn't it? Wasn't that the time of its greatest expansion, was before you actually had emperors?
Correct. So the Republic is, some people say that the Ides of March was the last day of the Roman Republic, so March 15, 44 BC. But certainly the Roman Republic was over by 27 BC, when the man we call man born Octavius becomes Augustus.
Well, wait a second. Before we get to Octavian, before we get to all of that good stuff, when we were still a republic, before Julius Caesar ever shows up, this is a very aggressive republic. This is a republic that doesn't seem to embody what we might think of as a more peaceful attitude that we sort of assume modern republics will have. There may or may not be true, but we tend to think of republican forms of government as not being inherently aggressive or oriented toward conquest. In fact, the more I think of it, the more I think that's a fallacy. But be that as it may, the Romans set the standard here. I mean, they might have had some degree of political participation, even some degree, small degree of egalitarianism within their society. But everybody else was barbarians and was fair game. And we're going to go out and we're going to take their stuff.
Right. And even people who are not barbarians, like sophisticated Greeks and Carthaginians, the Romans had no trouble taking their stuff. As you say, republics are not really all that peaceful. I think the pacifism of republics is partly an artifact of the liberal world order today, and particularly of the Pax Americana.
Yeah.
But republics 100 years ago looked like a very different sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably just a modern mythology, and perhaps I've bought into it a little bit. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're peaceful just because you've got political rights at home, and the Romans certainly showed us that thousands of years ago. Okay, so you've got the Roman Republic. It's extraordinarily successful. It is just kicking butt and taking names all around the Mediterranean, all the way up into Gaul, all the way up into Britain as far as Hadrian's Wall. It takes over these ancient empires of Greece and Egypt. I mean, nothing can stop the Romans, it seems, except the Romans themselves, because then along comes a fellow by the name of Julius Caesar. So now that we've set the stage, tell us all about this guy.
Well, Julius Caesar was a genius. He was immensely talented. He's one of the very few people in all of known history who was both a superb general, superb field commander, a superb politician, both an orator and a strategist, and finally a superb writer, a brilliant writer. You know, Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars and the Civil Wars remain classics today. You get very few people in history who can do all those three things. Mm-hmm. And he was a young man in a hurry, and although he had political principles, his most important priority was himself. He wanted to promote his career. He wanted to become the greatest man in Rome, and he didn't much care who he had to offend and who he had to stomp on in order to get ahead.
Did he come from a noble family?
Yes, he came from a patrician family. The Julii Caesares, as they were called, were one of the first families of Rome for a long time. They had fallen on somewhat hard times. When Caesar was young, they were not as great as they had been centuries earlier. So he's restoring the family to a former greatness, but it's still a very important and well-connected family. And it was certainly understood that he would rise to prominence in the Roman political and military class. Nobody expected him to become as the supremely powerful individual that he does become.
What was his route to power? Was he primarily a military leader or a politician? Which of those two things came first?
Well, like all Romans of his class, he starts out in the military. As a young man, he's very successful, and by the age of 20, he wins the second highest decoration that the Roman Republic has to offer for military valor. But he immediately launches into a political career in his 20s, and he rises to the very top of the heap by being elected consul, a one-year office. Also, by virtue of his remarkable political cunning and his real brilliance, He becomes part of an informal group of three, the Gang of Three. We call them the First Triumvirate, who run Roman politics behind the scenes. Unconstitutionally and illegally, they plot and control everything.
Who were the other two guys?
The other two guys were Crassus and Pompey. Crassus was the richest man in Rome, and he was eager to achieve military glory. Up until that point, he had not really reached the height of military glory, height of military success. The other man was the most successful general in Rome. His name was Pompey. Pompey had done a superb job both in Spain and in the East. He had conquered a broad swath of territory extending from modern Turkey down through to the edge of Egypt, and he brought them all into the Roman Empire. He'd also held a very important command at sea and defeated the pirates in the Mediterranean.
So you got three very powerful patrician noble guys who each want military glory. They've each got something going for them, especially Pompey in the military and Crassus in terms of finance. And so they're just jockeying for power.
That's correct. Caesar adds incredible political smarts and skills to it, as well as military talent. And he holds the consulship during... Now, Caesar's politics are populist, or I'll use the term populist loosely. Our term populist fits only loosely in the Roman environment, but he was an aristocrat who did not believe in democracy, but who believed in using the popular levers of power, that is going behind the Senate's back, and doing things for the ordinary people of Rome, improving the lot of the ordinary people of Rome. That made him a populist. He is very successful as a consul and very controversial. He uses violence to have his opponents beat up, for instance, literally beat up in public, and forced to hide in their own houses in order to get his laws passed. And after his year as consul, as is typical in Rome, he gets appointed as a proconsul, that is someone who leads an army and governs a province abroad. And the province that he gets is Gaul. At the time, Gaul consists of what's now northern Italy and the French Riviera, more or less, so just the southern part of France. Parlays this into this incredible command where he conquers all the rest of France, all of Belgium, a strip of Germany, a little bit of the Netherlands, and even invades England twice. He turns this into perhaps one of the very greatest commands that any Roman general has ever had, and enormously important because it brings France, what's now France, which is a Celtic civilization, it brings it into the Latin-speaking world and makes France, lays the foundations for France to be the country that it is today. It's why the French speak French and not Gaelic.
Yeah, French is a romantic language.
French is a romance language.
Yeah. Yeah, I said romantic. Romance. Yeah, romance language.
It's romance.
It's very romantic. Yes, I was thinking along different lines there. It's just a remarkable fellow then. So, and of course, he's sending dispatches back to Rome. And I'm guessing that that's making Pompey and Crassus and his other rivals increasingly jealous.
Absolutely. By conquering Gaul, he also becomes the richest man in Rome, wealthier than Crassus. He also, and he's building up enormous political power. He's building up wealth that he can use to buy friends and influence in Rome. But he's also making friends with the elites in the areas that he conquers, because Caesar is a very far-seeing person, and he understands that Rome cannot indefinitely continue the tens of millions of people it's conquered. It cannot indefinitely continue to treat them as subjects, to keep them trodden under the Roman sandaled foot. Eventually, the Romans have to make deals with them, particularly with their provincial elites. And Caesar, like Pompey before him, understands this and starts cutting deals with these people, much to the horror of the old, narrow nobility in Rome. Caesar wants to come back from Gaul, and he wants to be rewarded by becoming one of the top politicians, one of the most influential and respected people in Rome. His enemies in Rome, particularly the conservatives, see him as a disaster, a threat to everything they hold near and dear. And they eventually strip him of his command and make him fear for his life. They make him fear that if he comes back on Rome, he will be put on trial and threatened with execution and forced into exile.
My, my. So things are going poorly back home for him.
Yes.
So what does Julius Caesar do at this point?
Okay. Well, Julius Caesar calls his army together and says, the Roman Senate has been taken over by a faction of hard-lined, wealthy people who want to take away everything that I have won for you. And by hurting me, they are hurting you. They are unconstitutional. They are not behaving according to the rules of the Republic. They are not playing fair with the Roman people. And the only way for them to stop them, my friends, is for us to march on the city of Rome and to liberate the Roman government from these horrible revolutionaries who have taken it over.
And that was the cardinal sin. Now, we're not going to digress too much, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this had only happened a couple of times in earlier Roman history under a fellow named Sulla, who had gone in to clean house under a similar rationale and actually had stepped back after he'd cleaned house. And that was Caesar's precedent. But the Roman Senate was very much aware of Sulla as well, and they'd actually declared that no Roman general could approach any closer, I think, than the Rubicon, the river in the north of Italy, right?
Correct. The Rubicon's a little stream that marked the boundary between the province of Gaul and Italy proper. And the Romans believed that no general should be able to march with an army in Italy without the permission of the Senate, and really only when the Senate was allowing him to come home to celebrate a triumph or victories abroad. By crossing the Rubicon, which Caesar did on January 10th, 49 BC, he violated Roman law and in effect declared civil war on the Roman government.
Did they raise an army to oppose him? What happened when he crossed the Rubicon?
Caesar had an almost unbeatable army, the army that had conquered Gaul. The Roman government, even though it has Pompey, who's a superb general, to defend it, is simply not able to match the army that conquered Gaul. So Pompey and his troops evacuate Rome and Italy, and they take ships. They take ship and they flee to Greece, where they're calling in for allies and building up a new army. Caesar tries to stop them. He's so fast. Speed is one of his hallmarks. And you know, he gets to the docks and nearly stops Pompey, but is unable to do so. So the Roman government, the legitimate government of Rome, if you will, Caesar didn't believe they were legitimate. They're in Greece in exile, building up an army. They have the navy. Caesar has no navy. They have the entire navy. And they're building up an army to train to use against Caesar. And Caesar has control of Rome and Italy. What follows is a civil war that lasts for almost 5 years before Caesar finally conquers virtually all of his opponents. There's a little pocket of resistance left in Syria and some people who've taken to the hills in Spain. But otherwise, Caesar has conquered the whole thing.
So at the end of 5 years, he's effectively in charge of everything. Now, at that stage, though, Rome is still calling itself a republic, right?
Yes.
And so Caesar is simply what, the proconsul, the consul? What is his actual role in this?
Caesar is the dictator. Now, the Roman Republic traditionally had the idea that in times of emergency, they would suspend the constitution and appoint one man to be dictator for 6 months, only for 6 months. For 6 months, he would run the state so that you would have somebody coordinating the show, running the show, one man rule in times of emergency. Sulla had the office of dictator hadn't been used for centuries when Sulla revived it about 40 years before Caesar, and he turned it into an open-ended institution, though he steps down as dictator before 2 years are up. Caesar's dictator for several one-year terms, then at the end of the Civil War, he has himself declared dictator for 10 years, and then he does something that no one had ever even dreamt of before. He has himself declared dictator in perpetuity.
Okay, now here we come to something I think is really going to help people understand what made him different. We've mentioned this guy, Sulla. Sulla was, you know, 40, 50 years beforehand. There'd been an emergency. He'd, or at least he felt there was. He marches on Rome. But he does, in some sense, what a dictator's supposed to do. He comes in, he solves the crisis, and then he steps down. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he did it twice in rapid succession. So he had done, in some sense, what he was supposed to do. Caesar, at least at first, looks like he's doing it, but then comes one term of dictatorship after another, then a 10-year term, and then finally he says, oh, the heck with it, guys. I'm just going to be dictator forever.
That's right. Yes.
That's pretty shocking. I can see that the Senate and the rest of the people in Rome would be shocked by this.
Not only does he do that, but he makes it clear in many ways that he's really changing the Roman system of government to a system in which Caesar and his family and the friend really pull all the strings. Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes, they're the folks who are pulling the strings. And this is a huge change from the system Rome had had. Before, it's true that only several hundred families dominated things, but that's more than one family dominating things. Now it looks like only one family is going to dominate things.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Are you enjoying this conversation as much as I am? I'm speaking with Barry Strauss about his new book, The Death of Caesar. After the break, we'll finish our discussion, which makes me sad because this is really cool stuff. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Barry Strauss of Cornell University about his new book, The Death of Caesar. Just before the break, he was telling me about how Julius Caesar was a remarkably talented person whose talents were perhaps only exceeded by his ambition. And his ambition was effectively to be the king of Rome. And isn't it remarkable how a successful, extremely successful republic that had been around literally hundreds of years could collapse in the face of a single tyrannical man?
And just to add a level of weirdness to it, Caesar has connections abroad that make many people wonder whether Rome itself is going to be calling the shots anymore. Caesar is famous for his love life and for all his mistresses, and when he was a young man, possibly for a boyfriend that he supposedly had. But he's most famous for his current mistress, who is none other than the Queen of Egypt, Cleopatra.
Oh my, I knew she was going to come into the story eventually.
Yeah. Caesar and Cleopatra are an item, and Cleopatra has had an illegitimate child who she says is Caesar's son, and most people believe this is true, that he really is.
Oh my, that brings up a succession issue.
It brings up a succession issue, but there's also the question of whether Caesar's going to continue hanging out in Rome. Is Rome big enough for Caesar? Or does Caesar want to move to a new stage, to Alexandria, Egypt, in the east? Rome, in spite of all its power, Rome was not a very impressive urban space. It was still relatively poor. Alexandria, by contrast, is the most glamorous urban city in the world, and it's a royal city, a city of kings, and always has been so. Here's Caesar, who has a mistress in Alexandria, who seems to be whispering into his ear, nothing less than being king is good enough for you, Caesar. How do we know this? Well, he starts dressing like the old kings of Rome, in purple robes and wearing the special red boots that the kings used to wear.
See, that's another thing that's important. Purple was the royal color. It was illegal for anyone to wear it.
Only when you're a triumphing general. But Caesar has the Senecius and the right to wear purple whenever he wants.
Oh, my.
And he sits on a golden chair in public. Normally, Roman officials sat on an ivory chair. But Caesar's chair is ivory and gold. And there are many other honors, such as being declared a god, that make people think he wants to be a king. Even though he denies it. He denies it when people call him, even when people call him king in public, he denies it. He ostentatiously denies it. A month before the Ides of March, He's called king in public. And he's almost crowned king in Rome. And he says, I want everybody to know, I want this to go into the official record of Rome. The people wanted to make me king, but I turned it down. So people are very nervous about what this guy is going to do.
Methinks the gentleman doth protest too much.
Indeed.
My, my, my. So this basically then this guy looks like he wants to make himself into a king or an emperor, and this is all coming to a head right in the spring or the late winter of 44 BC.
Precisely. Also, okay. Caesar is scheduled to leave Rome to start a new military campaign in the east, a vast new campaign that will conquer what is now Romania and go to war against the ancient Persian Empire, at least fighting them in what is now Armenia and Iraq, possibly even further east into what's now Iran. But it's going to be a massive campaign in the east. And Caesar has chosen his great nephew, his sister's grandson. Even though he's only 18, Caesar is giving him a high position in this campaign and seems to be grooming him for great things, perhaps even to be his successor. So all the more reason to think that Caesar is trying to create a dynasty that is un-Roman in the power that it will have.
And so who are his primary opponents, the ones who are going to get together and take matters into their own hands?
Well, his primary opponents are a series of conspirators, some 60-odd men. They are a hodgepodge. The majority of them, we are told, are people who had been Caesar's supporters on his way up, but they now think he's gone too far. And some of them are people who had opposed Caesar in the Civil War. They had fought with Pompey during the Civil War, but when Pompey was defeated and murdered, they went over eventually to Caesar's side, realizing they had to make their peace with him. The two most famous of them, the two who we hear about in Shakespeare, are, of course, Marcus Brutus and Gaius Cassius, two men who had not been Caesar's supporters when they were in earlier years, but who had gone over to Caesar during the Civil War and had been pardoned by Caesar and are now prominent politicians. The third one, who Shakespeare more or less leaves out, but a very important figure, is a man named Decimus Brutus. I call him Decimus. He was Marcus Brutus's distant cousin, a member of the Roman nobility, but unlike Brutus and Cassius, Decimus had been Caesar's supporter and had fought for Caesar in Gaul and during the Civil War. He had supported Caesar as well. When he turns on Caesar only when he realizes that Caesar ultimately is not going to make him his successor, ultimately is going to give power to others, and he understands that Caesar will be satisfied with nothing less than becoming a king. He's tremendously important in the successful conspiracy because he is an insider. He is a mole, as it were, who sees things from Caesar's point of view, and also because he has a troop of gladiators. Gladiators are sort of private armies, private security forces in a period in which there is no police force in Rome. And these gladiators can provide the muscle that the conspirators need as a backup to make sure nobody kills them after they kill Caesar. So he's a major figure in the plot as well. And there are many, many others, very important people. Many of them are military people. The impression we get from Shakespeare is that the people who killed Caesar were A, politicians, and B, amateurs. They barely pulled it off. It was a last-minute slapdash thing. The reality is that the leaders of the conspiracy were mostly professional soldiers, as well as being politicians. They knew how to take someone down. They knew how to run an ambush. And they were extremely competent in what they did. They planned for it well in advance. It was not slapdash at all.
And they decided on March the 15th, or the Ides of March, which simply indicates that it's the middle of the month, for a particular reason, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, they had to move quickly because on March the 18th, Caesar was leaving for his war in the east, a war that might last 2 or 3 years. So this was, once he left for war, Caesar would be surrounded by a military bodyguard. In the Senate, Caesar would have, in the streets of Rome, Caesar had only an informal bodyguard. In the Senate, he would have no bodyguard at all. He would be disarmed. So this was their last chance to get him. They wanted to kill him in a Senate meeting, and they wanted to kill him with their own hands because they wanted to make a statement. They wanted to advertise this to the people of Rome, not as some kind of private vendetta, but as a public act done by senators and soldiers for the benefit of the Roman people. The Ides of March was a particularly good day for them because the Ides of March was a religious festival, a spring festival in Rome, a day in which many of Caesar's constituency, the poorest people of Rome, would be off in the north of the city celebrating. It was a big day for a party. So this would be a good day to think there would not be a crowd around, a good day to get Caesar. So that's why they chose the Ides, for all those reasons.
And then on the appointed day, there he was. And what exactly happened? How exactly was he killed?
He was killed by daggers. The conspirators hid daggers under their togas and their tunics. They were attached to their belts. There may have also been some daggers that were smuggled in document boxes that were used in the Roman Senate. And on the Caesar had heard that there was a conspiracy afoot. The problem is there were always conspiracies afoot. There had been many conspiracies, and there were constant rumors of conspiracies. He didn't take them all that seriously. On the Ides of March, he actually did, because his wife, who was a political wife, very well connected, convinced him to stay at home. Caesar was not also a 100% healthy man. He was a man who suffered from epilepsy and mini strokes. And the night before the Ides, he hadn't been feeling well. So for both of those reasons, he decided to stay home. He almost never got to the Senate in the event. The way they got him to the Senate was the conspirators sent our friend Decimus, the mole, the inside man, to convince Caesar to go to the Senate after all. And so he did. When he entered the Senate house, one group of conspirators surrounded him. He was sitting on the podium, the far end of the Senate house, and they made as if they wanted to present a petition to him, as if they wanted to ask for something. So he wasn't surprised that a group of men surrounded him. They were really forming a perimeter. And one of them approaches Caesar, pulls down Caesar's toga. Caesar says, "What are you doing? This is violence." And suddenly from behind, the lead man, at a signal, stabs Caesar and tries to kill him. Unfortunately, he hits Caesar's collarbone and doesn't inflict a serious wound. Caesar gets up. According to one account, he grabs a pen and stabs one of the conspirators. He tries to fight back, but he's surrounded by them. It might have been the second wound, which is a blow under Caesar's ribs. That might have been the fatal one. There's an autopsy later that suggests so. But he struck 23 times.
Oh, my.
Meanwhile, some people in the Senate, some senators, some of his allies, try to get up to help him. But there's a second wave of conspirators whose job it is to prevent them from doing so, and they're unable to save it. So within minutes, Caesar is killed. He falls. The Senate meeting, ironically, is in the Senate House of Pompey, built by Pompey, Caesar's great enemy, to glorify himself. The Senate meets in different places from time to time. That day, it's the meeting there. Caesar literally falls at the foot of the statue of Pompey. I mean, no novelist could invent a better scene.
Yeah.
Where Caesar is assassinated, he's lying there. Most people run off in horror, and three of his slaves bring him home on the litter that he was carried to the Senate House from. His home is about half a mile away, but because there are only three of them and not four, the litter is crooked. And as he's carried from the streets of Rome, the mighty Caesar's dead arm is hanging out of the litter. A horrible sight that greets his supporters and his wife and the mourners who are there mourning when he comes home.
Oh, that is dramatic. What happened afterward, though? I mean, any good conspiracy's got to have someone ready to take charge afterward. Who took charge?
Well, the conspirators are now protected by a group of gladiators, and they march to the Capitoline Hill, the historic center, the fortress of Rome. And their supporters come up all day and all night to see them. They're trying to rally public support to their side, and there is a considerable amount of public support on their side. They're also trying to rally armies outside of Rome to support them, and they have a number of armies outside of Rome to support them. From Shakespeare, we learn that things go bad for them 5 days later at Caesar's funeral. when Mark Antony famously rallies Caesar supporters, both his civilian and soldier supporters, against the conspirators. But actually, things had gone bad for them before then, 2 days after the assassination. On the one hand, the good news is that the Senate agrees to votes an amnesty for all the conspirators. But the big mistake that the conspirators make has to do with Caesar's soldiers, because the majority of the troops of Rome had supported Caesar, or the most important, the most powerful troops of Rome had supported Caesar. The conspirators want to get them on their side. And the mistake they make is by not offering those soldiers a raise. What they say to the soldiers is, we won't take anything away from you. But in order to win Caesar's soldiers, especially after killing their chief, you have to offer them something new, and you have to put some of your own skin in the game. The only way to pay these soldiers more is to use your own money and tax your fellow wealthiest Romans. And Brutus and Cassius don't want to do this, and that's their big mistake. So Caesar's soldiers are up for grabs, and they're taken first by Mark Antony, Caesar's loyal lieutenant, and then by Gaius Octavius, Caesar's grandnephew, and the man who, according to Caesar's will, is his adopted son. He comes back to Rome, he takes the name of Julius Caesar, and he marches off to glory and eventually becomes the first Emperor Augustus.
Wow, and there's a lot of history there that we have just skimmed over, but that's really, as you had mentioned briefly before, the moment when the empire officially began to operate, because Octavius declares himself Augustus and is very open about saying, and I'm the emperor.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
So in some sense, like father, like son, or like great uncle and great nephew, and it's a generational thing, but eventually the house of Caesar makes it to the top.
It does. Yep, that's absolutely right. Now, Augustus is both more brutal than Julius Caesar. Caesar had pardoned his enemies. Augustus kills them. But he's also more diplomatic than Caesar, because once he's won the war, he says, it's time to make peace. I'm not going to be a dictator. Oh, no. Call me first citizen, or call me reverend. The word for reverend is Augustus. And he makes sure to leave some powers, some goodies, for the remaining members of the Roman elite, so he can get them into one big tent. So he's learned from Caesar's mistakes.
And so the Senate does continue to exist, but it's been reduced in status to what, some sort of advisory body?
It's an advisory body. It has some powers. Augustus leaves the Senate in charge of parts of the Roman Empire, but not the militarily strategic parts. It's as if the Senate controls provinces that don't have armies, that aren't that wealthy, that aren't able to compete with the real power in the state, which is the crucial, wealthiest, and frontier provinces where most of the armies are. Those are controlled by Augustus.
What a fascinating tale, and I'm sorry that we've run out of time, Barry, because this is obviously a story that deserves to be studied in great detail, and I'm sure everyone who's listening is going to want to go out and find out more about this by reading your book. So once again, what's the title of your book?
The title of the book is The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination, Simon & Schuster. Available on Amazon and
at your local corner bookstore, of course, too.
At your local corner bookstore, assuming we still have them. I hope we do.
I sincerely hope we do, too. Well, Barry Strauss of Cornell University, and currently on a fellowship at the Hoover Institution, which we thank for setting you up with your equipment on your end. Thank you very much for sharing this story with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Stuart, for inviting me to be on your show.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Barry Strauss of Cornell University for telling us about his new book, The Death of Caesar. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and experiments, as the Romans show us, can sometimes fail.